Welcome to The Conversation with Stu, the show where you'll meet cool people with interesting careers, stories, and knowledge. Learn more about the world and how to navigate in it. Hosted by Stu Ackerman, a man who knows a little about everything and has the perfect face for podcasting.
Steve Snyder, thank you very much for joining me. When I came across your profile and your book, I thought it was extremely fascinating. A story I haven't heard anywhere before. I believe it's won 20 national book awards. Your book Shot Down. And when I went to your website, I think I counted there were 32 awards there. How many awards did this book win?
Well, it's around 30 or something like that. There's on the paperback book at the headline, it says 20, because at the time I printed, had the paperback printed, it had won 20 awards, but it's won about 10 more or so since then.
And this book is in some of the national museums in the United States?
Yeah, it's in all the major ones. It's in the World War II Museum down in New Orleans, the U.S. Air Force Museum in Dayton, Ohio, and the Mighty 8th Air Force Museum in Pooler, Georgia, just outside of Savannah, but other ones as well.
I got the book and I really enjoyed it. What I really like is you didn't, we'll get into the whole thing. You didn't just tell the story about your father, which was itself fascinating, but you gave a nice education on World War II and really like all the planes and some of the terminology. So I think for anybody who doesn't have a wide array of understanding or vast knowledge of World War II will definitely get something out of this. So who was your father? Why did you write this book about him?
Okay. Well, my dad was a B-17 pilot, and you know, growing up, I knew the basic of my dad's World War II history. I knew he was a B-17 pilot. He was stationed in England with the 8th Air Force. His bomber, his B-17, was named the Susan Ruth after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time that he went overseas. And he flew bombing missions over Europe. And in February of 1944, his plane was shot down. He was missing in action for 7 months, but he evaded capture and eventually got back to England. But it wasn't until I retired in 2009 from my career job that I really had the time to delve into my dad's war history in more detail. My parents had kept a lot of information about the war years, and I just wanted to go through that, kind of organize it, learn some more details. And at that time, I had absolutely no idea of writing a book. That was the furthest thing from my mind. But two items were really significant that they had kept. One was a diary that my dad wrote while he was missing in action about his plane being shot down, and it is absolutely riveting. And then the other item was all the letters that my dad had written to my mother while he was stationed in England before he was shot down. And reading those was just amazing. He was really candid in those letters. He went into detail about what bombing missions were like, what life was like on the air base in England, what life was like in London and England at the time, escapades of him and his crew. And I just became fascinated with the story of him and his crew, and it became my passion. I started reading book after book about the air war over Europe. I went on the internet and spent countless hours doing research, downloading declassified military documents. I went on a quest to find relatives of all my dad's crew to see what information they could give to me, letters or articles, newspaper clippings, pictures, what have you. And I joined a number of World War II organizations, started to go to their reunions, listen to veterans tell their stories. And finally, 3 years into my research, I just came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his crew was so unique and so compelling that it needed to be told. People needed to know about it. So I decided to write a book.
Well, I was before we get into it, what I found interesting was going into the book, I had the idea, the understanding that I'd be learning about your father and about his crew and about the war. But what I took away that it was unexpected were all the people who helped your father. I found that was the most humane part of the story. And we can get into that later, but that to me was very fascinating because that was unexpected. You know, it's kind of like, you know, you watch a movie and you see what the plot is about. But then there's that kind of that little underlying story behind there. So that was interesting. So can you just explain just a little bit how it all started for your father in training? Was he drafted right away? Was he already doing some training? What was his pilot training like?
Okay, well, to begin with, he didn't go into the Air Force as a result of the first peacetime draft in U.S. history implemented by Franklin Roosevelt in the fall of 1940. My dad enlisted in the military in the Army in the spring of 1941. And he was stationed in Fort Lewis, Washington, and he was actually there for a year, and he was in the infantry training. But about 3 months after he went up there, he married my mother, Ruth Hempel. And that was in July of 1941. It was right after she graduated from UCLA. And then in December, 41, on December 7th, a date which will live in infamy, the U.S., the Pearl Harbor was bombed by the Japanese, and the United States was at war. Well, my mother was really concerned and frightened. Future was very uncertain at that time. So over Christmas in December, after Pearl Harbor was bombed, she went up to visit my dad in Washington. And 9 months later, Susan Ruth was born. And so at the time, my dad was worried how he was going to support his new family. Here he has a new bride, a baby on the way, and he didn't think he could do that very well on a private's pay in the Army. So he decided to volunteer for the Air Force where he could make more money, especially if he could make it through pilot training and become an officer. So in June of 1942, he volunteered for the Air Force and then started his training. He initially went through pre-flight training in Santa Ana, California. And from there there were three stages of pilot training, main stages. The first was primary training, which he took at Santa Maria, California. And then if you passed primary training, you went into basic training. And pilot training was really tough. 40% of the guys who went in washed out because, you know, not only did they have the physical aspects of it, but it was very challenging mentally as well. They needed to learn aerodynamics, meteorology, physics, mathematics. So there was a lot of school to go with becoming a pilot, you know, plus learning just how to fly a plane. And then after basic pilot training, they separated the pilots out. They either went into single engine planes, which became fighters, or twin engine planes, which then led into transports or bombers. Typically, the shorter pilots went into fighters because of the cramped conditions in the cockpit. My dad was 6'3", so he was one of the taller guys, and he played center in basketball, you know, back then at that height. But I think it was also based on personality. To me, it seems the fighter pilots were pretty cocky, had large egos, you know, risk takers, independent, whereas the bomber pilots tended to be a little more level-headed and team players. And so my dad went in the twin engine planes in advanced pilot training, which he took in Douglas, California. And then he graduated from advanced pilot training in April of 43, where he received his commission as a second lieutenant and his pilot's wings. And then from there, he went to transitional training where he learned how to fly a B-17 four-engine bomber. And then he went to operational crew training down in Texas where the various members of the crew came together. B-17 had a 10-man crew. The crew members came together, they learned to operate as a team, and then once they were deemed ready, they were assigned overseas to the European Theater of Operations.
And before they went there, I believe they were up here in Canada?
Yeah. From Texas, they went to Scott Field in Illinois, and then they went to Bangor, and then from there, they were going to fly their plane over to England from the U.S., So from Illinois, they went to Bangor, Maine, and then from Maine, they went to Newfoundland, where then they flew across the Atlantic to England.
So right. They did fly in the B-17.
Yes.
And
that was really scary.
What are the problems with flying B-17 overseas?
Well, you know, they flew at night, and he said it was just pitch black. You know, you couldn't tell if, you know, what was above you or what below you. You know, you couldn't tell the sky from the sea. And now he said that was pretty nerve-wracking. I think it was about 2,000 miles, and I forget off the top of my head how long that took. But there was a lot of bombers that, you know, went down in the Atlantic and was never heard from again, flying over to England. You know, they got lost or disoriented or what have you. So that was pretty nerve-wracking going over there, because they had done a lot of, you know, flying in the U.S., but never, you know, that long of a flight.
Speaking of the plane, the Susan Ruth, you said, was named after your sister. What was the nose art that was on the plane?
That's a good question. I love the nose art. I love to talk about it too. It's interesting that the Air Force was the only entity that allowed their planes to be painted. The Marines did not, the Navy didn't, nor did other countries. But the Air Force thought it would help the morale of these young guys if they could name and paint their planes. And they were very creative in what they named and painted their planes. You know, many times it was a cartoon character, but the majority of the time it was either a scantily clad or nude woman. You know, after all, these guys are in their late teens and early 20s and very young guys. The nose, I don't really know what the nose art was on my dad's plane. They painted it when they left Scott Field, before they left Scott Field to go over to England. But once they got to England, they were flying a brand new plane, and they took it away from my dad and his crew. And they just gave him some beat up old B-17 that had some battle damage. And he didn't feel those planes were good enough or nice enough or pretty enough to paint and do the nose art. And then when he finally did get a new plane, he only flew it a couple of missions before he was shot down. He never had enough time to get it painted. But my dad's plane wouldn't have been a scantily clad dude women, because after all, it was, you know,
right,
named after my little.
That's why I was thinking that. That's right. Yeah.
My older sister, but also my dad was really a strong Christian. And he was quite flabbergasted when he went over there and, you know, in the missing huts and the planes, you know, they just had, you know, the pinup posters and nude women all over the place. So he was pretty surprised by that.
You know, it's interesting when I was reading, I didn't realize that there were so many different positions in the B-17, especially the number of gunners. Can you get into that a little bit and explain that?
Sure. As I mentioned, the B-17 had a crew of 10. B-17 was nicknamed a Flying Fortress because of the armament they had on the plane. As you alluded to, they had, there was 12 to 13 50 caliber machine guns on the plane, so they put out a tremendous amount of firepower. Also, the B-17s could take a tremendous amount of battle damage and continue flying. But of the 10-man crew, they had four officers who were in the front of the plane. You had the bombardier, whose job was to drop the bombs accurately. But there were three different models of B-17s flown during the war. In the definitive model, the G model, which was the last one to come in, had a chin turret. And so the bombardier, if they were under attack by enemy fighters, would also man the chin turret. And then behind him sat the navigator. He needed to know where they were going and where they were. But under attack, there were two cheek guns on each side of the fuselage that he manned. And then up above them sat the two pilots. You had the first pilot in the left seat, which was my dad, and then the co-pilot in the right seat. And you needed two pilots to fly these planes because not just because if one was injured or killed, you had another guy to fly the plane, but it was very strenuous, both mentally and physically, to fly these planes. These bombing missions lasted 6 to 10 hours, and they flew in tight formation. So they had
What were the formations?
Well, they call it a combat box formation. And initially you had a three-plane element, a high of the element. You had a lead plane, and then you had a higher plane, then a lower plane. And then elements formed up into squadrons that also had a high lead group, a high group, and a low group. And then the squadrons formed up into bomb groups that also had elite group, a high group, a low group, and then they formed up into combat wings, and combat wings formed up into air divisions. And so you had hundreds of planes in these formations on these combat missions.
So did the B-17s face different threats when they were in combat and as opposed to when they were doing bombing runs? Because it sounds like it might have been a different type of flight and then different types of dangers they faced.
Well, they faced a lot of dangers to begin with. It was dangerous from the time they took off to the time they landed. At the peak, there were 40 bomb groups in the 8th Air Force stationed in England in an area called East Anglia, which was about the size of Vermont. And on the day of a mission, you had bombers taken off from all these bases at the same time. And these bases were only about 5 to 10 miles apart. And back then, there was no air traffic control. There was no radar. Everything was based on visual sight. And so most of the time, the weather in England was pretty crummy, you know, overcast, cloudy. They couldn't see anything until they got above the cloud layer. So mid-air collisions were not uncommon. And then they had to form up, you know, all those squadrons and bomb groups that I mentioned. And that took about an hour, 2 hours before they even headed across the English Channel to begin their mission. And then they had to deal with the elements. These planes weren't pressurized, so above 10,000 feet, they had to go on oxygen, or if not, they'd quickly pass out and could die. And also, it was extremely cold. It was minus 40 to 60 degrees below zero in these bombers. So frostbite was a huge problem, and there were many airmen that were hospitalized for lengthy periods of time because of their serious frostbite injuries. One of the gunners on my dad's plane was hospitalized for 2.5 months. Because of the frostbite injuries he had. And then when they finally got to the continental coast of Europe, the Germans sent up fighters to intercept them. The Germans had radar stations along the coast of continental Europe, so they knew when these bombers were coming over. So they had sent up their fighters, the Air Force, the Luftwaffe, to intercept them. And then so they had the fighter, fend off fighters, and then when they got near the targets, they encountered anti-aircraft fire, flak. They had these flak guns. Flak was an abbreviation for the German word for aircraft defense cannon. But they were deadly weapons. They fired 20 shells a minute, and they were calibrated to explode at the same altitude that these bombers were flying. And these shells were filled with all different shapes and sizes of razor-sharp metal called shrapnel, that when they exploded would burst out hundreds of feet and easily penetrate the thin aluminum skin of these bombers. And then when they dropped their bombs, and the bombers that were able to get through the bomb run okay, they would form back up and try to head back to their bases in England, where once again they'd face German fighters. So it was a deadly operation. There were 26,000 men that died in the 8th Air Force, which was more than the entire Marine Corps fighting in the Pacific.
Wow.
And another 28,000 men became prisoners of war after their bombers were knocked out of the sky, either by fighters or anti-aircraft fire.
What was the fighting support that the B-17s had? Did they have much support?
Well, at the initially, it was 8th Bomber Command's belief that these, you know, heavily armed bombers, you know, flying lots of them together in tight formations could defend themselves from the Luftwaffe. They didn't need any fighter support. But they were sorely mistaken. The bombers could not protect themselves. And when initially they did give them fighter support, whether it's British Spitfires or P-38 Lightnings or Thunderbolts, P-47 Thunderbolts, they didn't have the fuel capacity to escort the bombers all the way deep into Germany and back. They could escort them across the continental, across the channel into, say, occupied Europe and France or the Netherlands, but then they'd run short of fuel and have to turn around and head back to their bases in England. Well, the Luftwaffe would just wait until they turned around.
They knew.
They'd just swoop in for the kill. And the worst part of the air war was 1943. The 8th Air Force took devastating losses in 1943. They implemented it in the spring of 43, a mission limit of 25. If you completed 25 missions, you could go back to the States. But it was statistically impossible to complete 20 missions. The average number of missions flown before being shot down was only 6. So it was really rough. It wasn't until external fuel tanks were added to the P-47 Thunderbolts and the introduction of the P-51 Mustang right at the end of 43 and the beginning of 44, where these bomber formations finally had adequate escort support that could take them all the way deep into Germany to the target and escort them all the way back home.
Was that too little too late, or is that good timing?
Well, I wouldn't say it was good timing, because it would have been better if they could have figured that out. But the Mustangs were so effective that pretty much by the time D-Day rolled around on June 6th of 44, they had pretty much wiped out the Luftwaffe. So for the latter part of 44 and into 45, these bomber formations really didn't have to worry about German fighters anymore. They just had to deal with the flak.
Do you know if the Mustangs were created just for that purpose?
Yes, they were a pursuit aircraft. Actually, you know, I called a P-51, a P-47, a P-38, and P stood for pursuit. World War II, they changed the P to an F.
So they're basically an invention out of necessity.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So that's, and which one of the German fighters were the most effective at that time against the B-17s?
There were two, main ones. They were the Messerschmitt 109s or the Focke-Wulf 190s. The Focke-Wulf came along a little bit after the Messerschmitt. And I personally feel the Focke-Wulfs, because they were the ones that shot down my dad's plane. They were more dangerous and deadly than the Messerschmitts, but you know, that's up for your argument.
Well, okay. So I can't imagine. So what were the major problems if the pilots, the B-17 bombers, if the crew survived, were some of the most notable side effects that they had when they came back? Besides, I understand if the plane was hit or what have you, but there were other problems that they faced when they returned.
Well, mentally, for sure, if that's what you're implying with, they didn't call it PTSD back then. They called it flak happy or shell shock or things like that. But, you know, being a combat crewman in the 8th Air Force was the most dangerous duty assignment in the United States military during World War II. And these guys, you know, they never knew if they were going to come back from a mission. And they'd come back, and there'd be empty bunks from guys that got killed. And they had to deal with that. And they knew going back out, yeah, that, and, you know, especially in the early years of the war where they were being shot down, you know, just very frequently, you know, that was a lot for them to deal with. But those guys, you know, they didn't call them the greatest generation for nothing. You know, they just kept going back up and going back up. So that, you know, that took a lot of guts and fortitude. And after all, as I mentioned earlier, these guys were just, you know, young guys in their teenagers or early 20s, just out of high school, probably never. A lot of these guys, back then, the U.S. was a whole different country. It was a very rural country. Most people lived out, you know, in farms, unlike today where most people live in cities. Mm-hmm. A lot of these guys had never been away from home, never even been out of their home county. And all of a sudden, they're halfway around the world, you know, fighting a war and having guys and their buddies dying around them. You know, they didn't like to, they stuck pretty close to their own crew. They didn't like to make a lot of friends because you were going to lose them.
Yeah. Wow. So how many missions did your father fly on?
He was shot down on his 8th mission. He and his crew reported to the 306 bomb group based at Thurlow, England, which is about 60 miles north of London, on October 21st of 1943. And then he was shot down on February 8th of 44. It was his 8th mission.
Okay, so what I find extremely ironic is the fact your father went on 8 missions, shot down on the 8th, yet the most notable injury that I read was the basketball one.
Right.
What was that all about?
Well, as I mentioned, he was a captain on the basketball. Well, he was a center on the basketball team, and the commanding officer of his bomb squadron was a basketball player, and so they, yeah. they were very competitive. My dad said that he almost felt these basketball games were more important than the bombing missions. But my dad tore his ligaments in his ankle in one of the games, and so he was out of commission for 2 months. He couldn't fly for 2 months. So some of the members of his crew had more missions than he did, and others had less than he did. I mentioned that one of his waist gunners, who has hospitalized for frostbite injuries, I think he only had 5 missions before he was shot down. Okay, so, and it's interesting. My dad only flew with his full crew twice. The mission he was shot down on, and then the mission before that. A lot of people think that because guys would get sick all the time. The weather in England was damp and wet, and everyone's getting colds and pneumonia, and people were getting injured in these on these combat missions. So it was rare that a whole crew was able to fly together at the same time until later in the war.
Could you do your best to run us through his missions up to the point where he was shot down? If you can, just throw in the really important details, any really good stories there that you want to include, something that's in the book even, up to that point. And then I want to divide that and then talk about what happened when he got shot down.
Okay. Yeah, because the book, the first half of the book builds up to the day they were shot down. And then the second half of the book is all about what happened to him. To him afterwards. My dad flew his first mission on November 3rd of 1943. It was a mission to Wilhelmshaven, Germany, and it was the first.
Just lost you there.
Fairly uneventful, but they got tougher as they went on. But yeah, he said, even though it was so cold on those bombing missions, when they'd start their bomb run, and they started their bomb run at a pre-designated point called the IP, the initial point, which is about 20 to 50 miles from the target. And when they'd start that bomb run and they'd start heading into those, that flak, that anti-aircraft fire, it was like going into, a killing zone. As these shells, when they exploded, they would just violently rock the ship, the concussions of these shells exploding. And even though it was so cold at that altitude, my dad said he'd just be dripping with perspiration. His clothes would be soaked from sweat because of the adrenaline running through his body. So that was pretty scary.
I'm sure. So from the first mission up until the seventh, was there anything that was a large event, a big event for your father? Any victories, major missions that were successes, or even something that was a failure?
They went, they had to fight, they got attacked by enemy fighters. They had to go through the flak and they dropped their bombs. Nothing in particular. None of his crew got hit or injured on those first missions. The only one was the waist gunner who had the bad frostbite injuries, and then his ball turret gunner got injured when they were taking some evasive action, but nothing really out of the ordinary.
Okay, so then
they did have a couple engines got knocked out. So, they were coming in on two rather than four engines, which was a little dicey.
So what were the details when your father got shot down?
As I mentioned, February 8, it was a mission to Frankfurt, Germany. They dropped their bombs successfully, but their bomb bay doors got hit by flak, an aircraft flyer, and they couldn't get them back up. And as a result, that caused the drag on the plane. They started losing airspeed and they started lagging behind the formation of bombers heading back to England to their bases. And they were singled out by two German Focke-Wulf fighters, like wolves or lions, coming down on prey. They came in for the kill. And in the ensuing air battle, the Susan Ruth was shot down. But both those Focke-Wulf fighters were shot down as well. One was piloted by Siegfried Merrick, and it crashed and he was killed. And the other was piloted by Hans Berger, who was able to bail out of the plane and he made it through the war. Before I started my research, all my dad knew and all the military records showed was that my dad's plane was attacked by two German Focke-Wulf fighters. And that's I thought all I'd ever know. But one day when I was doing my research, my wife just casually threw out, well, why don't you try to find the German fighter that shot down your dad's plane? Which I thought was a ridiculous idea. She doesn't know what she's talking about. I'm never going to be able to do that. He's probably died during the war. He's 70 years later. He's probably passed away. I can't speak German. Wild goose chase. But I, like a good husband, I did what she told me to do. And I found Hans Berger. And fortunately for me, he became a translator after the war, so he speaks perfect English. And I found out that the gunners on my dad's plane actually shot him down at the same time that he shot down my dad's plane.
Wow.
So they shot each other down. So that was incredible. And I interviewed Hans for the book, and he gave me some wonderful information about what it was like to go up against the Air Force during the war.
So how long after your father was shot down did it take him to get to find his way back?
Well, he was missing in action for 7 months after my dad bailed out as he came down in these trees and his parachute got hung up in the trees and he was dangling 20 feet off the ground and couldn't get down. But fortunately for him, a couple young Belgian men came to his aid before the Germans could get to him. They went back to the farmhouse, got a ladder and a rope, helped him down out of the tree. This occurred in the early afternoon, and they told him to stay put and hide because they thought it was too dangerous to try to move him during daylight with German patrols combing the area. So that night they came back and got him. The two men were Henri Franken and Raymon Durvan, and they took him back to the Durvan farmhouse where he stayed one night only because they thought, again, it was too dangerous for him to stay there any longer than that with those German patrols right there in the area. It was right at the French-Belgian border. So the second night, a Belgian customs officer named Paul Tilcan came with a tandem bicycle to take my dad to another location. My dad had some superficial burns on his face because the plane was on fire before he bailed out. The cockpit was on fire. And he had some slight wounds in his leg, one leg from shrapnel. So he could only pedal the bike with one leg. And they came to a hill. And they couldn't pedal the bike up the hill anymore, so they started pushing it up the hill. And when they got to the top of the hill, there was this cabaret or cafe. The lights were on, music was playing, people were talking loudly and laughing. All of a sudden, two German officers come out with these young girls, with their arms around young girls. And one of them comes up to my dad and asks him for a light for a cigarette, which my dad's, you know, paralyzed. He can't speak German or French at that time. They speak French right near in lower Belgium. But Paul, you know, lit the guy's cigarette. He knew what he was talking about. And my dad said these Germans were too drunk, too interested in these young girls to pay too much attention to two guys pushing a bike up in the middle of the night. So they let him go on their way. And then after that, my dad was moved from place to place to place.
Wow.
How long he stayed in any house depended on how brave the people were who lived there and how dangerous the Belgium underground thought it was for him to stay there. He might spend one night. He might spend 6 weeks. And the people who hid my dad, or any down airman for that matter, are unbelievably brave people. If the German secret police, the Gestapo, found out about it, those people would be arrested, tortured, neither shot or sent to concentration camps. And some of the people who helped my dad did meet that fate.
Wow.
Finally, though, my dad just got tired of hiding because it was also very stressful for him. And there were several instances described in the book where he was almost discovered by the Gestapo. And word had come that the Allies had landed at Normandy on D-Day, June 6th. And so he decided to get back in the fight. Unlike most other airmen, you know, he had that year's infantry training before he went into the Air Force, so he knew how to fight on the ground, and he thought it was his duty to get back in and fight the Germans. So he decided he wanted to join the French resistance, and his helpers tried to talk him out of this because it was way too dangerous. He could either die in, you know, fighting them, or if they captured him, he'd be considered a terrorist and be shot on the spot. But he convinced them he wanted to go join the French resistance. And so one of his helpers, they rode bicycles across the border of Belgium into France, and he hooked up with a unit of the Mackie. That's what the French resistance were referred to, which were, the Mackie were small independent guerrilla groups located all around France that would harass the Germans. They would disrupt communications, sabotage railroad lines, assassinate German officers, attack convoys, and there's several encounters that my dad's group had with the Germans that are described in the book. And they got their instructions from the British over the BBC through coded messages, and they were supplied by the British through airdrops. So we fought with the French resistance for a while, and then on September 2nd of 1944, word came that there were U.S. troops in the little nearby village of Trelon, France. So he walked into town, into the town square, went up to an army major, actually. It was an element of Patton's Third Army, which had come up through France after D-Day. And my dad identified himself. They interrogated him to make sure he was who he said he was. Then he caught a convoy going to Paris, and then a transport from Paris, then back to England to his base. So 7 months missing in action. And when he got back to England, he sent a telegram to my mother saying he was fit as a fiddle and to bank the money, honey. He had let back pay coming.
So your mother didn't hear from him for about 7 months or maybe more. What was going on in her head at that time?
Oh, it was really difficult for my mother because not only did she have Susan Ruth, who was 1 year old, but my other sister was born while my dad was missing in action. So here she had a little infant baby as well. And, you know, she got a telegram from the War Department, copy which is in the book, after they were shot down, telling her that my dad and really the whole crew was missing in action. But she heard nothing else, you know, for almost 8 months until my dad got back to England. So that was a joyous day, without a doubt. I mentioned all those letters that my dad had written to my mother before he was shot down, and there's excerpts of those in the book, but there's also excerpts from letters that the family members wrote to each other after the plane was shot down, which were very moving, you know, mothers, wives, sweethearts, you know, writing to each other, trying to console each other, you know, praying and hoping for the best, that their loved ones would come back. And of the five-man crew, five of them did come back, but five of them did not. So it was heartache for those five families.
Okay, Steve, you need to find a movie producer because this would make an awesome movie. It really would. Like, the story is unbelievable. I don't want you to give away too much information. Do you want to let the listeners and people watching know maybe a little bit of what happened after the war, who you met up with, who your father may have met up with?
Sure. Well, the people that hit him in Belgium, who we stayed with for lengthy periods of time, they kept in touch after the war. They would correspond, send Christmas cards. And then later in life, and it was the first time was in the late 70s, my dad went back to Belgium to visit some of them. But in 1989, this organization, Belgium, called the French, the Belgium American Foundation, was founded by a guy named by the name of Dr. Paul Delahaye. He was a young boy during the war and greatly affected by it. He formed this organization to remember and honor the Americans who came to liberate them from Nazi occupation, and they erected a memorial to my dad and his crew in the little village of Mackinaws where the plane came down. And my dad and the other three crew members that were still living at the time went over for the dedication. And there he was reunited with more of the people that hit him during the war, visited these homes he was hidden. And that's like most World War II veterans, he didn't talk a lot about the war until that moment because that brought it all back. And then I made my first trip to Belgium 5 years later in 1994 when my wife and I accompanied my parents to the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Belgium and of my dad's plane being shot down. And that's when it became personal for me. Uh-huh. I've been to Belgium now 6 times, developed some wonderful friends, lifelong friends. A lot of these houses and farms that my dad was hidden in or where the French resistance group stayed are still there today. I've been inside those, you know, houses and been in rooms where my dad was hidden. I get chills. Just talking.
Yeah, yeah. I get chills just listening to you.
So it you know, you can, you know, go to these places where the history took place. And I've been to Munich, Germany twice, where Hans Berger lives.
Wow.
He's 96 years old now. He's the only person involved in the shot down story, whether it's a member of my dad's crew or Belgium helpers that's still alive.
Wow. What an unbelievable story. The book is Shot Down. Fantastic book. So you really brought history to life, I thought. I'll put a link to your book underneath the video. Where else can people find you and find the book?
Okay. Well, most people get the book on Amazon. It's available on hard cover, soft cover, audio book, ebook, all formats, and an Audible book. However, the print book, the paperback or the hardcover, they have over 200 time period photographs in the book, so you can visualize everything you're reading about, which makes a big difference. If someone wants to go to my website, which is stevesnyderauthor.com, you can get an autographed, personalized copy on the homepage. There's a little buy now button that you can hit and pay by credit card through PayPal, and then I'll sign the book and send it to them. But that's available really wherever books are sold, you know, Barnes and Noble or what have you. But over 50% of all books purchased are purchased on Amazon.
Steve Snyder, Shot Down, fantastic book. The story was great. I loved hearing it. I loved reading it. And I want to thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me on your show. I greatly enjoyed it. Since I wrote that book, it's changed my life. I go to air shows all over the United States, signing copies of that book. I do lots of speaking to organizations, and it's trying to keep the memory alive of those great men who sacrificed so much.
You're doing a great job at that. Thank you.
Thank you.